You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois, and streaming online at weft.org. Stay tuned now for Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with disability advocate and my good friend Michelle Westmoss. But first, disability news for the week of July 14th, 2025. Federal officials will allow employers to keep paying some workers with disabilities less than minimum wage. The U.S. Department of Labor has withdrawn a proposed rule that would have phased out subminimum wage jobs where people with disabilities can legally earn below $7.25 an hour under special 14C certificates. The Biden administration had pushed to end the program, citing better job opportunities for people with disabilities, but now the Labor Department under the Trump administration says the certificates remain necessary for many workers despite their sharp decline in use. Disability advocates call the decision disappointing and say subminimum wage jobs promote exploitation. Meanwhile, some parent groups support keeping the program, saying it offers vital options for those with significant disabilities. New guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend that doctors use genetic testing earlier when evaluating children with developmental delays or intellectual disabilities. Genetic issues are behind up to half of these cases, but often testing isn't done. The Academy says early genetic diagnoses can help guide treatment, connect families to resources, and inform future family planning. Doctors are advised to start with genome or exome sequencing along with chromosomal analysis. If no cause is found, follow-up tests are recommended. The report stresses that while specialists can help, general pediatricians need to know how to start the evaluation themselves. This guidance follows a study showing that fewer than 1 in 5 children with autism or intellectual disabilities on Medicaid receive recommended genetic testing. Researchers say that gap leaves many families without answers that could potentially improve care. A new drug is giving hope to people with Prader-Willi syndrome, a rare genetic disorder that causes life-threatening hunger. The condition affects about 20,000 Americans, leading to constant food cravings, so extreme that families often lock cupboards and refrigerators. But now a newly approved medication called Vicat XR is helping ease those symptoms. Doctors say the drug calms hunger signals in the brain, allowing some patients to live more independently and even attend college, milestones that once seemed impossible. However, the treatment comes at a steep cost, around $466,000 a year. Drug maker Solena Therapeutics says most patients will pay very little out of pocket. Meanwhile, researchers worry that federal budget cuts under the Trump administration could slow future breakthroughs for rare diseases and obesity treatments. For patients like 16-year-old Dean Schenck, whose hunger once controlled his life, the drug has been life-changing. His mother says, quote, "Now we have our son back," end quote. And finally, a first-of-its-kind national soccer league for athletes with intellectual disabilities is kicking off this summer. Called the Inspire Soccer League, it launches in August with four teams competing in Colorado Springs, Colorado, followed by more events nationwide and a championship weekend later this year. Backed by U.S. Soccer and founded by two former professional players, the league offers year-round competitive play for athletes 16 and older. Games will be held in pro stadiums as ticketed events. Most teams in the new Inspire Soccer League will partner with professional clubs and feature at least 15 players with intellectual disabilities age 16 and up. Games will take place at pro stadiums as ticketed events, with organizers aiming for crowds of about 1,200 people. The league plans to expand next year to eight teams across two conferences, with 11 events on the schedule. Organizers say Project Inspire offers a higher level of competition beyond Special Olympics, with hope of building U.S. national teams for future international play. And that's the news for this week.
Some get their kicks from champagne. Beer alcohol doesn't thrill me. Hello, so tell me, why should it be true that I just get a kick?
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today by my good friend Michelle Westmus, who has such a long biography that I couldn't possibly give her all the credit she's due today, but know that Michelle is one of the leading advocates in the state of Illinois and has been for a number of years. And I've worked with Michelle since, how old was Bradley when we started? Second grade, maybe kindergarten,
and maybe preschool, kindergarten.
And he is now how old?
27.
Yeah, it's been a long time, but it's been a great decade. Adventure. Welcome to the program, Michelle. So
Thank you for having me. Since
I didn't introduce you very well, why don't you do a quick synopsis of who you are and talk a little bit about your experience with Bradley?
Okay, so I was a teacher when my second child, Bradley, was born with Kabuki syndrome. And so I found myself unable to head back to the classroom. And like so many of us parents, I decided I would work in the disability field. I realized there was a lot of knowledge I needed to raise this particular kid. And the best way I could get it was if my job was surrounded by all that information. So I was lucky enough to work for the Family Support Network of the Arc of Illinois, and then with the Association of Microboards and Cooperatives, and I worked with the Illinois School for the Deaf Outreach and Hearing and Vision Connections. And so I had a lot of opportunities for statewide advocacy, which allowed me to know who's who and what's what, and put Bradley in a position to have the best life possible.
And so after all your experiences, let's talk about what you found that has been most effective in helping him.
Well, I think I remember working with the legislative and policy advocacy with the Arc of Illinois and how very frustrating that was, right? Because it feels like progress is moving at a snail's pace. And then I also remember going to the state of Minnesota website, Parallels in Time. You know that website where you can mm-hmm. go through the entire of disability history from ancient times, right?
Right.
And I remember thinking, you know, we really are making a lot of progress. Like, there's no better time to live with a disability than now. But in our lifetime, it feels really slow. And then when we were able to work with directly with families, with the Association of Microboards and Cooperatives, I think that's what really changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
I had people like you and many others from the time Bradley was very little teaching me about inclusion and possibilities and belonging and all of that. But then when we really got deeper into person-centered thinking, that really made a difference. And I think that that is where people can find, I'm thinking of the words, it's like a mindset shift that has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, because I know so many parents out there who think that they need to live one day longer than their right. child with a disability, because they're the only ones that can be there that will protect them and make sure that they get their needs met and, you know, all the things that parents worry about, usually until their child turns 18. But
right.
for a family member, a parent of a person with a disability that's more significant, it's much more challenging and much more worrisome, right?
Exactly. And I one of my most recent opportunities was I started a community college program for young adults with developmental disabilities.
Oh, yeah, you left that one out, Michelle.
Yeah, I left that one out. That was kind of big. And I think, you know, when students would come and we would start talking about planning for the future, many of them just, you know, I'm going to live with my mom and dad forever. And it is like that can't be your plan, because mom and dad's forever is not as long as yours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not going to work. Like, that just isn't going to work. So we've got to think of something else. And I know nobody wants to think about it. It's terrifying.
It is terrifying, but
we have to think about it.
You have to think about what's going to happen if my family member with a disability does live with me, and I'm planning on being around forever to take care of them, and all of a sudden you're gone.
Right, and it's not just that we're gone; it's just that we're incapacitated for a week.
Well, that's
like,
true.
If I come down with wicked COVID for a week, what's going to happen to my person whose life revolves around me? That can't happen. And I remember recognizing that Bradley's life can't be limited to what I can create. I'm one person.
Yeah.
And I am not, I mean, I'm pretty darn fabulous, as you know, but Bradley's life should not be limited to what I can make happen. You know, and I think, so one thing I tell people that I've discovered, we really have to work hard to recognize that we don't know what our loved one with disabilities can do, because we have no historical opportunity for anyone to show us. People with disabilities have always been isolated, no expectations, nothing. So we have to give each person the tools, the support, and the opportunities to show us what they can do. We have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, with Bradley's syndrome, you know, if we look at the generations of kids, you can see that medical advances have made better possibilities for people just health-wise.
But in society, that's not necessarily the case. The medical breakthroughs
right.
are awesome, but people's expectations of those with disabilities
right.
limits them to group homes, sheltered workshops, day programs, isolated settings like that, where they
right.
don't make community connections. Let's talk
exactly.
a little bit, maybe talk a little bit about Bradley's life and
mm-hmm.
start by, you know, maybe explaining his disability a little bit so that we can not
yeah.
go into this with people thinking, well, he's very high functioning, and that's why right. this can be done. There are a lot of needs there that need to be addressed, right?
Well, that's a really interesting perspective, because I think, you know, people meet Bradley and think he's just special. That's why he's, because he's in an inclusive college program right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's not, he's darn special. Of course he is. He's my kid. But he's no more special than your kid or any other kid. He just had opportunities. And because I had the time and energy, you know, I mean, it does get complicated, right? We know that we can only beat down so many barriers because we just don't have the energy, but we've got to beat down all we can.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bradley, on paper, has a huge list. He's got hearing loss, vision loss, speech impairment, orthopedic issues, balance issues, sensory defensiveness, sensory processing issues, autism spectrum. He had a feeding tube till he was a year and a half, blah, blah, blah. Like, you read his list of things and you don't know how this person gets out of bed in the morning, but he's at college right now, like passing regular college classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, honest to goodness, I don't know how he's doing it, but he is. And if I had... if I had limited him to only what I absolutely knew he could achieve, he wouldn't be there, right? Because I couldn't picture, how is he going to manage in the dorm by himself?
Well, let's talk about that.
He's going to do a paper? He's going to write a paper? But he is.
So what connections made that happen?
I think, so... he's always been in a regular classroom. So that was very important to us from the time he was three. And this is because I had people like you and others who gave me the idea of inclusion, so that from his, at his very first IEP meeting when he was three,
mm-hmm.
I had a 15-page parent input report that went into detail about, we're not closing any doors for this kid, because I'm assuming that he can have every opportunity his brother without disabilities has, and we're going to make sure that happens. So I had to fight very hard, because kids like him went into the self-contained classroom and stayed there the rest of their life, and Lynn lived in the group home in town, which was lovely. And I didn't want that for Bradley. So I fought very hard for him to be in regular classes and having access to the regular curriculum. And I believed wholeheartedly that he needed to have all the experiences the other kids had, even to, in regular pre-K, you know, they sing all the songs, they read all the books that we all know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the special ed one, they're not doing all those things. Because they're too busy. I don't know what they're too busy doing, but they're not reading Brown Bear, maybe, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then, you know, and so he was, at the same time he was in regular ed with his non-disabled peers participating in extracurricular like band and drama and the things that were interesting to him, he was also going to camp at the school for the deaf and the school for the visually impaired and spending time with other people who had challenges like his, because he also needed to know, how do I understand myself and exist with these challenges? You know, he needed to have an opportunity to interact with his peers with disabilities to know how to be, how do I raise a child to be an adult with disabilities when I don't know what that world is like. I used to think of it as, Bradley has genetic similarities with his Kabuki syndrome siblings and peers, the same that he does with his blood brother, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it was like, he's got genetic similarities with this group of people that he didn't get from his dad and I. So it's almost like I kind of, I do really well with analogies, so I kind of thought of it as if I adopted a child from another culture, I would make sure that child had access to that culture. And so I wanted to make sure he had access to this world of disability. What is, how can he be a vital adult with disabilities? We took him out of school every year to go to the art conference with me and to learn the skills he needed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken him time. He's 27 now. He went to some community college classes right out of high school at 18, 19, and he didn't do very well because it was difficult for him to advocate for what he needed. Mm-hmm. But he's gained maturity and self-awareness now that he can ask for what he needs. But, you know, we can't be the parent that doesn't want our kid to be feel bad about their differences, so we're not going to talk to them about it. I've had to work really hard and intentional for him to understand how his experience of the world is different than other people's, so that he knows what he's missing and he knows what he needs. Does that make sense?
It does, but tangentially, I'm sure that you as well benefited from that connection to the Kabuki parent group, because you
exactly.
learned from them and had other connections that maybe Bradley could utilize down the road.
Exactly. And like, we had one friend in our community who's a older, maybe 5 or more years older than Bradley,
mm-hmm.
who is a really brilliant man with autism. And he is just gifted at explaining to regular old people how he experiences the world with autism. And it helped me so much to understand how Bradley might be experiencing things before Bradley could tell me himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we kind of immersed ourselves in disability culture, not just advocacy, but culture,
mm-hmm.
so that we could understand it and help him fit in as much as possible.
So talk a little bit about maybe one or two of the connections that Bradley made along the way that really helped move this concept forward for you?
I don't know if I can think of one.
Well, he got involved in drama pretty early.
Right. Well, I think, you know, this takes me to one of the tenets of person-centered thinking is finding where you belong. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Bradley, like, I talked to him about everything and explained what we're doing all the time. So he now knows the value of connections. And he's intentional about finding the people that share his passions and connecting with them, communicating with them. So, for example, he's always, since about six years old, he's been all about Broadway musicals. So, of course, he had to be involved in the theater program at his school. And when I remember his first cast party freshman year, and we're in a very rural town at the time, so I kind of knew everybody, but not that well. And the cast party was at a person's house that I didn't know. And Bradley wanted me to go with him and just, you know, go sit in the kitchen with the mom. I'm like, I don't know this mom. I can't just do that. So you're going to have to figure it out. And he had one best friend he was going with. But I was worried that he would sit in the corner rocking and humming,
mm-hmm.
stressed out and not participating in the party. But he didn't call me to pick him up until midnight, when the party was ending. And it turned out they were playing Glee karaoke, and he was a rock star because all the other kids knew the songs from Glee. But he knew what Broadway show they were from, who produced it, who starred in it, what year it won a Tony, all the things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you put him with his people, and they appreciate what makes him unique. If he was with the football team, they wouldn't have found that fun. So, you know, for us, it's been finding the places that that people appreciate him and where he can shine, and also empowering him to walk into a room feeling like I'm Bradley and I'm all that, and you might know, you know, because he's got visible challenges, so when you walk into a room, people know he's got differences, and he needs to be able to walk in with confidence that he belongs, you know?
Right. So think about, you know, 30 years from now, and Bradley will be 57 instead of 27. And
I'll be gone.
And you may be. We all may be at that point. And so what's your hope for Bradley? And, you know, by building these connections, what's your hope for him long term?
Well, you know, now we as you know, we developed a micro board for Bradley, a very coordinated circle of support during his school years. But then he went to a transition program and COVID happened and now he's at college and we don't have a circle anymore. So when he graduates and moves back home, we'll need to be very intentional about developing a strong circle of people around him so that I can be less and less of the center of everything.
Right.
And, you know, he used to think he wanted to live on his own. Now he knows he's going to have to live with me for a little bit just to, like, find his way, right? Mm-hmm. But I do hope that he'll live on his own, whether that's with a roommate or whatever, just on his own, meaning not with his mother.
Right, right. So it could be a roommate. It could be some kind of a shared living situation. But I'm thinking that Bradley does not want to live in a group home.
No, he does not.
And that seems to be like the ultimate solution for so many families out there. And it's not easy. It's not, not a given that it's going to be a great situation.
Right, because there's too many restrictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we've been raising our kid in an inclusive life, inclusive education and inclusive life, and then all of a sudden we put him in a restricted adult living situation where we have to take showers on a schedule because we just do logistically, it doesn't work if everyone just does whatever they want when they want to. And we have a meal schedule and stuff. For some people, they might like that routine.
Mm-hmm.
But Bradley might like the routine, actually, but he wouldn't like the limitations.
Yeah, I could see him going crazy over the limitations that would be imposed on him in that situation. Oh, Michelle, we are out of time, I'm afraid.
I thought that might happen.
You knew it would. Yeah. But, you know, I'll bring you back another time. We'll catch up on what Bradley's doing and how it's going and give us more of your perspective, because I think it's really a really, really progressive one that I think people appreciate. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Good to talk to you.
Always good talking with you. Michelle Westmus, parent, advocate, and just all around great person. Thanks for being on the show today.
You too. Thanks, Vicki. Bye-bye.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'm staying. Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Stand my ground, and I won't back down.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Cranford Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. Cranford Center is proud to announce their 2025-26 season, including performances by Herbie Hancock, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and the 20th anniversary of the Elnora Guitar Festival with Roseanne Cash, Jeff Tweedy, and many more. Complete information is available at CranfordCenter.com.
You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio, so stay tuned for that and other great programming here on Community Radio all evening long.